Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Have you heard you can listen to your favorite news podcasts ad-free? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or visit amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free and catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, interesting weekend in Washington, D.C. Had hundreds of white supremacists, or as the article reads, hate group Patriot Front goose-stepped their way through downtown Washington on Saturday. They were beating a snare drum, carrying shields, American flags, some of them upside down, others bearing the Patriot Front logo, and a large banner reading Reclaim America. Now, according to the American Southern Law Project, the Southern Poverty Law Center, the Patriot Front group, they are considered a white nationalist hate group. Evidently, they spawned out of this Vanguard America group. Don't know much about it. And that, I guess, splintered out of the 2017 group that guy who killed Heather Heyer at the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville. This is how we get to this place of another crazy right-wing hate group having a weird march where they have their uniform, the khaki pants. Yes, that is the new fascist outfit. The blue kind of jacket, vest, and a white mask. And all I kept thinking about as I'm watching these idiots march is doing their goose step thing is, you know, where's Jake and Elwood when we need them? And if you don't get the Blues Brothers reference, you need to go watch the Blues Brothers. There is that. Interesting news also, real quick. Devin Nunes says he's going to be leaving Congress by the end of the year. How am I now going to find out about Devin's cow? You know, now I'm going to miss it. And you go, but where's Devin going? Well, evidently, Devin's going on to greener pastures. Him and his cow. He is going to become the CEO of Trump Media and Technology. I'm reading this. I'm going, really? Going to give up the 174-year gig as a congressman to go work for Trump Media? Did anybody bother to tell him that Trump has a history of stiffing people? And I'm sitting here thinking, I'm going, I hope not. I hope he does get stiffed in the worst way possible. Because it would be poetic justice, would it not? And it is kind of, I don't know, kind of curious that the guy who was making Saturday night runs to the White House to kind of snitch on what was going on in the House. You know, on you know, people looking into Trump's, you know, dealings with others. that he would now be the, well, the choice to be the head of Truth Social? Is this a truth or is this a double truth? Could you re-truth me and my cow? Oh, it's crazy, crazy stuff. I'll tell you, and we live in such a weird time. And this is where, you know, here's the thing that bothers me. You know, I look at these people who, it really is a game to them. It really is, you know, it's about the money for them. And it's, you know, they're not in Congress to serve. They're not in Congress to make people's lives better. They're not in Congress to move this country forward. They're in Congress to divide. They're in Congress to destroy. These are destroyers. These aren't builders. You know, my grandfather always said, you can give it, any idiot with a hammer can tear down a house. It takes a craftsman to actually build one. You need to know what you're doing. So is it surprising that Lauren Boebert and Marjorie Taylor Greene and Matt Gaetz and that the Cawthorn kid from North Carolina, that they're super popular with the radical fringe? No, it's not surprising, because they don't know anything other than outrage. They don't know anything other than, hey, how can we be decisive, divisive, and destroy things? There isn't a piece of legislation between any of them. I've yet to see a piece of legislation that they've proposed that would make working people's lives better. And this is my problem with the Republican Party. And I hope there are Republicans listening. I want to reach out to you. I want to talk about policy. I want to go, hey, how do we make this a better country? How do we keep our kids safe? How do we have better neighborhoods and better schools? How do I have to not worry about my kids every day when they go to school? I got an email today, that the middle school that my daughter goes to, there's a threat. We can't tell you what or who. We can't tell you anything because they have privacy rights, but there was a threat. So now I'm freaking out. I'm going, okay, what is it? I don't know. We can't tell you. Who is it? Can't tell you. All we know is that there was a threat in the school. And this stuff happens over and over. And what do the Thomas Masseys of the world do? They pose with guns around a Christmas tree. Because Jesus would be packing, wishing for more ammo from Santa. We are in the screwiest of screwy times. And the people that we call our quote-unquote leaders are lunatics, half of them. Look, I'm not going to say that the people in the past were, you know, were saints, but things got done. And that's where I want to be, in this place where things get done, where I don't have to worry about our kids being able to go to college, that we'll be able to afford it. I mean, the reality of what we've done just to that one institution. I mean, we've privatized and robbed and thieved from generation after generation by handing more to corporate interests over the years. But student loan, this is one of the most egregious. The fact that you can get out of school and end up hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt. And yeah, maybe you get a law degree. But do you know what the average salary for most first-year lawyers is? You know, it's like in the $45,000 to $50,000 range. Are you going to be able to pay a $200,000 student loan back? No. Now, do we need more lawyers? Well, I would argue probably not. But the idea is we want people to go to school. We want them to get educated. We want them to have skills for the future. We want and need this stuff. And in past generations, we said, you know, we need to fund that. And how do we do that? By having a sane, rational tax code. One that doesn't say, oh, Jeff Bezos, don't worry about it. You're good. Elon, don't worry about it. You're good too. You other 745 billionaires who pocketed $2.5 trillion during the pandemic, don't worry about it. You're good. Let those poor kids take out student loans. Much better. Skin in the game. Make them work harder. It's kind of like those hungry kids, you know, they'll work harder. I mean, think about how weird of a society we've become. And I'd love to hear your thoughts. 1-866-416-RICK. 1-866-416-7425. It's crazy to think that we're going to have a society of educated people who allow this system to happen. Now, the argument that I get, usually from people my age, who go, well, you know, I had to take out a student loan, and I paid it back. You go, yeah, you did. And understand, here in Pennsylvania, where I'm at, the reality is the Commonwealth picked up 3/4 of the cost. You picked up 1/4 of it. How about we flip that math around and you now got to pick up 3/4 of it? Oh, and by the way, you had a fairly stable rate and you got some forgiveness and you got a lot of things in there because we hadn't completely set it up in a predatory fashion because, hey, it wasn't all about the profit. We now live in a time where it is all about the profit. It's all about the kleptocracy. How much can we steal from the working class and make them think that, well, it's their fault? Because how dare you want to have an education? How dare you want to do better for yourself and your family? Now, look, I hope Joe Biden does something. He's going to have to do something. There's talk of in the House, I guess, of forgiving 50,000. There's talk of from the Biden camp of 10,000. I'm of the mindset, no, let's not do the forgiveness thing. Let's do the, how about we take some of this money that we're borrowing, because we can get it at really cheap rates. We don't even need to do this through a government agency. We can set up a private corporation to do this. We can borrow money from the Fed and in huge amounts at such a low rate. In fact, you know what they were doing during the years past? They were borrowing money at negative rates, which means they were losing money giving it to us just so it wouldn't deflate any further. We could take some of that, we could buy up all the student loan debt, and we can make people pay it back. Make them pay it back. None of the predatory stuff. You borrow $10,000, you pay $10,000. If we need to go, okay, hold on. No, Rick, that's a bit too generous. We need 1%, maybe 3% for servicing. Because we're gonna have to have people do this. Okay, that's even fair too. You're going to pay a straight 3%. That seems sane and rational. This idea that I've heard people paying, you know, 9, 10, 12%. I've heard people who, you know, they took a break because they lost their job or they got sick or something happened. And then bang, before you knew it, they owe double of what they were at before. It is crazy what we've done. And yet there will be politicians who look us straight in the face and say, no, that's just someone who's getting skin in the game. It's just skin in the game. It's infuriating. It's angering. And until we figure this out, until we get to a point to where we do something better, smarter, we're going to keep screwing my kids, your kids, and future generations. For what? Because they wanted to have an education. Because they wanted to get a better job. Because they wanted to lead a decent life. Because they wanted to live that American dream that we dangled out in front of them. And said, sorry, snatch it back. It's absolute lunacy. And until we change things, it's going to continue. Until we figure out how to change this, it is going to continue. And it's not going to get any better anytime soon. And again, it comes back to us. It comes back to you and me. It comes back to the policies that we push for and the politicians that we put into these places. I'll tell you, it's, until we change things, it's going to get worse. Let's check Julie in Minneapolis. Julie, how are you today?
Hi, Rick. You know, I always think of my mother. I'm a baby boomer. My mother... both my parents were up in years a little when I was born. My mother was in college back in the 1940s in Minneapolis. She actually went to a private school. She went to Augsburg University. Oh. And it's pretty incredible because the government paid 1/3 of her college tuition. And she was able to talk the president of this small school then into letting her work as the assistant librarian 6 hours a day. So the government paid for 1/3 of it, and she worked as a librarian and then borrowed some money. But, you know, couldn't have gone to college without it. It was actually left over from President Roosevelt. You know, his old version of Build Back Better was the wonderful WPA
right.
program. And, you know, It would be fantastic if we could have something like that.
I agree.
What do you think about that?
Thank you. I agree. Thanks for the call, Julie. I appreciate it. I'm in this place where we do need the kind of massive investment that we saw during the FDR years. I've been calling for a new deal for quite some time. In fact, I was calling for that during the Obama term because we need that kind of investment. And while your mother may have paid two-thirds of the tuition, the tuition was still much lower because we were subsidizing the schools at much higher rates. The prices for university have just gone through the roof. In fact, you know, you go and you do the BLS calculator stuff, and you find that an education at Yale would be like $17,000 in today's money instead of the $60,000, $70,000 that it is. So it was a completely different structure, and we need to return to those days. Those were the days that made opportunities available to folks. At least that's my thought. All right, Julie, I appreciate the call. No, I mean, this is what I would love to see more of. This kind of idea that we've tried the profitization way. We've tried the corporate way of doing things. We've tried going, hey, predatory lenders, by all means, rob and cheat and steal from our students. We've tried it. It's failed. It's now time to go back to what built the most prosperous working class in the history of civilization. That those New Deal ideals that we're seeing right now under attack. And what's frustrating to me, and I've been saying this for the longest time, the current Republican Party is all about undoing the New Deal, repealing the 20th century, and all of the progress and all of the steps forward that we've made as a society. You know, they'll tell you, their courts will tell you, their judges will tell you, their original intent is, we want to return to the original intent of the Constitution. You know, those blacks in the field, women's in the kitchen, and gays in the closet. Only white landowning males, they're the ones who can vote. It's infuriating. And yet they're so good at dividing us. But this isn't the student loan stuff. This is an issue that should be uniting us. Because look, I got Republican friends too, who they're complaining about, hey, I can't afford to send my kid to college. Oh, hey, I can't afford the student loans that my kids... Have you seen the outrageous rates? Yeah, I have. Which is why we should be doing things. And this isn't just education. It's healthcare. It's retirement security. It's all of those institutions that were built out of New Deal programs. Social Security wasn't the main retirement plan. Social Security was an anti-poverty program to make sure that no one fell through the cracks, that you weren't eating cat food to survive. But you were also supposed to work and have a defined benefit pension and some savings. What's happened over these last 30 years, Reaganomics forward? Well, they've eviscerated defined benefit pensions and your savings. Those have gone too because wages have been declining for 30 years. And until we wake up and say no more, and I'm so optimistic right now because we are seeing people who have said, I've had enough. We are seeing people who are angry, and I'm hopeful that they'll get angry at the right stuff. I'm hoping that they'll get angry in a direction that says, let's get something done. Now, I see the idiots marching through Washington with their khakis and their blue vests and their white masks and their little uniforms, goose-stepping their way through because they're going to reclaim who knows what for their corporate overlords. But the rest of us, you know, I'll tell you, we've got to do something to make sure that we turn things around. That is it's my view on it. But I hope you... I hope we come around to it. I really do. If you missed any of today's program, therickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast. Make sure you get the podcast. Follow us on social media at Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Lots of ways to participate, lots of ways to get around to knowing what's going on. It's an opportunity to engage and to organize around how do we make things better? How do we move the country forward in such a way that, well, we have the hope and opportunity that my grandparents wanted us to have. I'm going to take a quick break right here. Stick around. Listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1907. That was the day an explosion rocked Fairmont Coal Company's number 6 and number 8 coal mines in Monongah, West Virginia, killing 367 miners. Newspaper reports estimated the number of dead to be as high as 500. It is considered the worst mine disaster in the history of the United States. Most miners were killed instantly, as the explosion destroyed the mine entrance and its ventilation system. Those not killed instantly suffocated from poisonous gas. Earth tremors were felt 8 miles away. The force of the explosion buckled pavement, collapsed buildings, and derailed streetcars. More than 3,200 miners had died in 1907. There were 3 more mine disasters before the end of the year. The last month became known as Black December. In January, a coroner's jury verdict ruled that a blowout shot ignited coal dust and made a number of recommendations for safer practices. But David McAteer tells a different story in his history of the disaster. He argues that the tipple had a design flaw that led to occasional coal car derailments as they exited the mine. And on this day, there had been a derailment with coal cars crashing at the bottom of the shaft and taking out the electrical and ventilation systems with it, igniting the coal dust in the process. The disaster generated a surge in demands for greater mine safety, leading to the creation of the Bureau of Mines in 1910. The Bureau could conduct research and safety training, but were powerless to conduct inspections or safety enforcement. Miners would continue to fight for the better part of the century for safety regulations and enforcement. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
866-416-RICK, 866-416-7425. Your thoughts, questions, comments. Let's go to the phone lines. Got Alice on line 3. Alice, how are you this evening?
How are you?
I am fantastic. What's on your mind?
Well, I wanted to comment on the student loans and also the quality of the educations. I graduated from Waynesburg University in 1985, which at that point it was Waynesburg College. It's a private little Christian college, quote-unquote, in southwestern Pennsylvania. And when I had taken out my student loans, they went through the local bank. But in between that time period and graduation, that was when they started transferring them to these private corporations.
Yeah.
And that was just the downfall of everything. As you said, they used to have you be able to have a deferment or what have you. And in between all that, I had paid my student loan down to around $1,300. And over the years, and we had a crisis come up, illness, and the next thing I knew, I was paying back thousands and thousands of dollars. The original amount of my student loan was for like $14,500, and I ended up paying over $30,000 back.
And the thing is, Alice, that's tame by today's numbers. Some of the things I've seen are just completely outrageous, which is why we need to do something about it.
Oh, absolutely. My son also went to Waynesburg. He's still paying back his student loans. And my granddaughter, she graduated 2 years ago, and she was looking at colleges and universities, and she had thought about going to Waynesburg. But it's so prohibitive now, it's just she can't do it.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy, which is why we've got to be pushing, pushing the Biden administration, pushing the Democrats in the House, and especially in the Senate. Because Republicans aren't going to be any help on this, even though they should be. This should be one of those issues that unites us as a country, because we want an educated population. We want our kids to be able to get an education. We don't want them saddled with a lifetime of debt so that they can't get out of the house and go start their own lives somewhere else out of my house. I'm making a joke. But we got.
I knew that.
You got a bunch of people who aren't able to move on.
Yeah, it is totally insane. The way And the thing with Republicans is, any time that they say, oh, well, we can do better by privatizing, you just know that's going to come back and bite everybody else in the hind end.
That's how we got here, Alice. That's how we got here. But thanks for the call. I appreciate it.
Okay, you have a good evening.
Great stuff, as always. Good stuff, Alice. No, this is why we've got to do something about it. We need smart policy. And speaking of smart policy, I'm excited by the fact that out in California, there is going to be an initiative to push for an $18 an hour minimum wage. Our good friend Joe Sandberg, who is a business leader, investor, he's the on the board of the Center for Health and Democracy. He's one of the co-founders of Aspiria Bank. He's done all kinds of great stuff. One of the progressive leaders out there, but he's single-handedly at this point, it appears, pushing to get this initiative through, and that's why we've got Joe on the line. Joe, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So why are you jumping in the middle of this? Why an $18 an hour minimum wage? What's up?
Well, we've talked about this before. If the minimum wage had increased at the rate of productivity since 1960, it would be $24 right now. And California had been a leader in raising the minimum wage, but $15 is stale now in California. There are over 5 million people who are working at the minimum wage in California. Everyone knows cost of living here is really high. And frankly, 18 isn't enough. 18 is a compromise that we're taking to the ballot because we want to make sure we win. It really ought to be 24. Why are we doing this now? Because I think that people's empathy has been heightened after the pandemic, where they've seen that the workers that are helping us when we're most vulnerable, who are caring for our family members when they're sick, are also the same workers that are making crap wages and can't provide 3 meals a day for their kids. And I think that this is a moment to go big on trying to raise the wage. And then I think the final thing is there's no action in D.C., so we have to lead as citizens. And, you know, really am grateful that I'm in a position to exert this pressure on the system, and I hope we'll succeed, and I think we will succeed.
No, I hope so. Look, I mean, the sad reality is on the federal level, we haven't seen an increase in the minimum wage in, what, 12 years now?
Yes, that's right.
Which is just unconscionable. And, you know, the states have tried to do a little bit, but I don't think that they've kept up. And I think it's ridiculous that you have to come out and be the one that pushes this. Why hasn't the General Assembly and the legislature there in California or the governor pushed for this? Because this has got to be popular with working class people.
Oh, it is popular. That's why I think we're going to win this. To your question about why others haven't stepped up, well, there are a lot of great allies we have in the legislature who are supporting this. Something this big requires executive leadership, and, you know, I hope the governor will, will join our coalition.
Now, when you say coalition, it's so far it's you and?
Well, we're going to have a big coalition, actually, Rick. We just haven't announced it
yet.
We just filed on Friday, and the truth is, one of the things that I know most from my career is that you don't accomplish anything by yourself. And everything that I've been able to do in my career that's been good has been the result of a great team that I've been able to build. We're going to have a big team of people from the private sector, from the public sector, elected officials, unions that are coming on board. This is actually sparking a lot of excitement. So I want to make sure that I paint the picture clearly. This is not a one-person show. I think I'm sparking it, and I'm glad to be the spark, but the success is going to be the credit of a big alliance of elected officials, labor leaders, and business leaders as well.
I hope business leaders, because, you know, for the longest time we've had, you know, the National, you know, the Restaurant Association coming out, the other NRA saying this is a job killer. Anytime you increase the minimum wage, Joe, you know it's going to kill jobs. It's going to kill jobs, Joe. You know it.
Yeah, I mean, here's the problem that those cynics face is they've been using the same broken arguments now for 20 years, and I think voters have become desensitized to them. The minimum wage ballot initiative throughout the country has had great success. There's something like 14 minimum wage ballot measures that have won consecutively around the country. There hasn't been a minimum wage ballot measure that's lost anywhere in the country, I think, since 1990. And the reason is voters see that when they raise the minimum wage, what happens is not the scary thing that the cynics say, but rather consumers have more money to buy life's basic needs, and businesses have more business, hire more workers, and you create a virtuous cycle. So I think they're going to have to come up with some kind of new argument, but I believe they've tried everything under the sun. And the fact is, voters like a higher minimum wage because it puts more money in the pockets of people who need it.
Yeah, I mean, if we can give, you know, billionaires, $2.5 trillion during the pandemic, they saw their wealth go up. We didn't tax them anymore. If we can do that, if we can afford that, I think we can afford, you know, the people who actually create the wealth and do the work and were the heroes during the pandemic. I think a reasonable living wage is not too much to ask. At least I don't think it is.
Of course, it's not too much to ask. And, you know, let's talk about another one of those broken arguments that really ought to be discarded into the graveyard of dumb ideas, which is this notion that if we raise the minimum wage, somehow we're going to have $30 hamburgers. You know, show me one place in the country that's raised the minimum wage that's selling $30 McDonald's burgers. It's just not a thing. It's this idea that the far right wing, you know, corporatists want to propagate to scare people. And I think people have wisened up to it because, you know, the far right has used this argument repeatedly, yet no $30 McDonald's hamburgers anywhere that I see.
Yeah. Now, this is another one of those things where I like to believe that this is an issue that I do believe could unite us as a country. Look, we're so divided on so many issues. This is another one of those that I think should unite us. The right wing keeps telling us, you know, we want people to go to work. We have to have work. I keep saying there should be reward for work. So there's some common ground. We want people to work. We want them to work hard. We want them to do a quality job, but we should also pay them a reasonable wage. I've often asked people, how much would it cost you to come just stand in my driveway? How much is your time worth? Nobody ever says $7.25.
Of course. And you're right that we should be able to rally around this idea, which I think is as American as apple pie. If you work full-time, you should live with full financial security. If you work full-time, you should be able to afford life's basic needs. That should be a fundamentally popular and unanimous principle. And actually, I think outside of Washington, D.C., and some of the, you know, echo chambers on social media, I actually think it is a pretty widely held principle. Let's look at Florida, which had a $15 ballot initiative for the minimum wage in November of 2020. 61% of Floridians voted for it.
Yeah.
You know, not often do you get 61% of Floridians agreeing on anything. That $15 minimum wage ballot measure outran President Biden by 13 percentage points. So I think we're going to actually win this in California by a pretty big margin. For all these reasons. And we're going to campaign in a way that builds unity and consensus. Like, we're going to proactively campaign to the business community and to small businesses and medium-sized businesses in particular, because here's the fact. When we put more money in the pockets of consumers, then people have more money to spend at small businesses, and then those small businesses make more money, and they need to hire more workers. Like, we should be the party of small business.
Yeah, absolutely.
The monopolies, they don't need any help.
No.
Businesses that have a couple of workers, they should be part of our coalition.
And they should be the ones screaming for it because those are their customers. It's more money in their customers' pockets, more money in the business. This isn't difficult. This isn't rocket science. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Joe Sandberg, progressive business leader, investor, co-founder of Aspiration Bank. All kinds of good stuff. Also, he sits on the board of the Center for Health and Democracy. He's right now spearheading a charge to raise the minimum wage to $18 an hour in California. You got a question, comment, something on your mind for Joe, give us a call, 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425. Still got a couple minutes. But here's the thing, and this is where, you know, I get to this hope. The hope is that idea that work should be rewarded and respected. And I believe that a reasonable wage is part of the way that you show respect for a job. I don't know that, you know, $7.25 an hour shows any respect for folks on a job, which is why I think you're seeing a lot of people up and quitting in the jobs that we're seeing, the low pay, the poor treatment, the poor working conditions. I think we're at an interesting moment right now where I think, you know, people are going to demand it more than we need initiatives for it. I'm curious your thoughts.
Well, you're right. Of course, $7.25 isn't dignified, nor is it humane, nor is it good for the economy. I return to this really simple observation that we've talked about many times. We have a consumer economy. And in a consumer economy, when people who need to buy things don't have money, you don't have a very fast-growing economy. For 30-plus years, people who've needed to buy things in our country haven't had money, and all of the money has been concentrated in the hands of people who don't need to buy anything. And as a result, you have a very sluggish consumption.
Yeah. No, and but they're always happy to give us credit.
Always. Yeah, always. You don't need a degree in economics. You just need third-grade arithmetic to understand that if your economy is based on consumption, when you put money in the hands of the people who consume things, who need to consume things, you're going to grow a lot faster. That's what this is about. This is an economic stimulus package for California as much as it is a living wage package for workers.
No, excellent point. So last question I've got for you. How do we help get this pushed along? How do people across the country help you guys in California push this through? Because, look, you know, if California does it, maybe another state's going to go that way, and maybe eventually we force the federal government to raise the wage for everybody, and we move forward for everyone. So how do we help?
Well, Rick, you're really more right than you might even realize. I think some of the opposition that we're going to face here in California are going to be from groups outside of California who are concerned that if this passes here, it's going to set a trend for the rest of the country. Well, the first thing is please have me on your show again soon, because we're going to be rolling out a lot of places where you can sign up to support. We're going to need volunteers to gather signatures if you live in California. We're going to need people to phone bank to turn voters out. So anywhere in the country, when we get closer to Election Day next year, if you can make calls from your cell phone wherever you live, that would be a great way to help. And we need donors. You know, nothing good happens with one person. It has to be a big coalition of big donors to small donors, everyone in between. And we'll be rolling that out over the next month. And I hope I can come back on and tell you about that.
Absolutely. When you got a website and a way to go, we'll make most certainly get there. Because I know the NFIB and the other NRA, I know they're going to be dumping tons of money into this. To try and take this down. So we're going to need people power because they got all the money.
You're right.
Good stuff, Joe. Appreciate the time. Again, come back as soon as you got something.
Thanks a lot. Talk to you soon.
Good stuff. Our good friend Joe Sandberg. No, look, you know, at the end of the day, you know the National Federation of Independent Business, one of the lobby groups. You know the Restaurant Association, the other NRA. You know they're going to be spending tons of money to make sure that they can keep that $2.13 federal minimum wage for tipped employees. Did you know that's the federal minimum wage? Most people are shocked to realize that the federal minimum wage says $2.13 an hour for tipped employees. Some states have gone above that. In Pennsylvania, I think it's like $2.96 or something. Eventually, you have to get the minimum wage with tips or however they calculate it. And how one person explained it to me is, whatever the check amount is, so let's say you had $100 on a check, just using easy numbers because I'm not very bright, 8% of that they would take as what you should have gotten in a tip. The other goes towards taxes and whatever else, but they charge you 8%, and that's what your number is. So let's say you didn't get any tips. They think you automatically did, and let's say you didn't get the tip money that you were supposed to. You could literally be working for less than minimum wage. It is that kind of crazy how things work out. But ultimately, it's going to come down to you and me and the rest of us. I say all the time, the rich have all the money. We've out-procreated them. And while we still can, before they destroy our ability to vote for people who will move us in a good direction and will push for policy going to help, we got to get registered. You got to get registered to vote. You got to get out there. And when election time comes around, you got to vote for people who are going to stand up and fight for we the people. That simple. And not the people who are telling you, oh, let's burn everything down. Well, the people who are going to say, hey, we're going to return reward to work. We're going to make it possible for families to get ahead. Just my thought. Love to hear yours. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back after this. Stick around.
I'm Rick Smith.
And this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1869. That was the day black workers met in Washington, D.C. to found the Colored National Labor Union. 214 black trade unionists hoped to work toward equal representation in the workforce. They also demanded anti-discrimination legislation, federally funded education, and the fulfillment of the promise of 40 acres and a mule for Southern farmers. 34-year-old black caulker Isaac Myers was elected the organization's first president. He had organized black caulkers in the Chesapeake shipyards. Myers hoped to lead black workers into the National Labor Union, an early effort at building a national labor movement. National Labor Union founder William Silvis insisted there should not be distinction of race or nationality among the ranks. Myers added that white and black workers must come together in solidarity and organize for higher wages and living standards. Many members of the National Labor Union were not so progressive when it came to integrated unions. Some of these organizations had whites-only clauses in their bylaws. Others feared competition from black workers and voted not to extend membership. Myers understood the need to organize black workers. While the National Labor Union did not live up to its stated ideal of inclusion, Myers' efforts welcomed all workers regardless of race, gender, or occupation, and represented workers across 21 states. They were soon met with the full weight of resistance that hostile bosses, media, and the government brought down upon them when they tried to push for reforms of any kind. Though the Colored National Labor Union soon fell into decline, black workers carried on its ideals of interracial solidarity during the Great Strikes of 1877. So did the new Knights of Labor, who insisted an injury to one is an injury to all.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, former Kansas senator and presidential candidate Bob Dole died. Was never a big Bob Dole fan, to be honest with you. I'm not going to say bad things about him. He's passed. I wish his family the best. But he was the guy single-handedly stopped the strike replacement bill from getting through that Clinton had promised to get through. He single-handedly filibustered that, as I remember. He was 98 years old. There is that. Anyway, here, let's get some thoughts from our good friend, former Ohio congressman and political analyst, Bob Ney. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, thank you, Rick.
So I'm sure you knew Bob. I'm sure you know yeah. Bob Dole. Everybody knew Bob Dole. One of the things I loved about Bob Dole is he always referred to himself in the third person.
That's my one. Of course, I was around Dole all the time. He was in the Senate when I, you know, first went into the House. But I remember when he came to see a state rep that was visiting D.C., and I went back in the Senate dining room, and I said, hey, Tom Johnson's out here. We went into his office, Rick, and it was just the three of us sitting there, and he had a Christmas tree, and there was a fire lit in the fireplace. And he looked over at Tom and I, and he said, what do you think about Bob Dole's Christmas tree? So he did it in private as he did it in public. Always third-person referral. We're just sitting there going, yeah, it's nice, Bob Dole. Yeah, nice Bob Dole tree.
Like I said, I never really thought much of him, to be honest. I'm angry about the strike replacement thing. But, yeah, like anyone who passes, I wish their family the best. And at this moment, I've got nothing ill to say.
Yeah, so. And he was a good veteran.
Yeah, I mean, and that was the thing. I mean, he was the last presidential candidate to have been in World War II. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's something. He was 98. Let's move on. China. Interesting. There's a lot of interesting stuff going on with China. Evidently, we're not going to send diplomats to the Beijing Games. And then they, I guess, responded by saying good, because there'll be less people bringing a virus into the country, which is kind of a shot to how bad we've done.
Well, you know, of course, we get back to the Olympics when Carter was president, and, you know, everybody kind of went crazy over that. The athletes didn't go. And I think in the past, too, the United States, I remember there was a minority conference in Africa, and because Cuba, through the UN, was the official host, the Congress and the administration wanted to boycott it. you know, my thought at the time is, okay, if they like Cuba or they don't, go down and participate. Sort of like McCarthy not being on the January 6th committee, right?
Right.
If you're not there, you can't, you know, you can't participate. And so I'm glad the athletes are going, but I thought it was a good move by the president to say, okay, we're going to boycott in a diplomatic way.
Yeah.
Of course, China's very aggressive. You know that. I know it. We've dealt with them for years. And I thought their comeback was okay, although I would like to come back and say, well, let's see, that virus kind of didn't come out of the United States.
Yeah. No, I mean, there's that. But, you know, at the end of the day, I'm against boycotting the Olympics.
Right.
Because that's supposed to be how we, you know, we come together as a globe.
Right.
There's a lot of messaging in that. The diplomatic stuff, fine. Keep your politics away from it. There shouldn't be that anyway.
Right.
But for the games, for the athletes, no, I'm not in favor of boycotting that. Now, the right wing, I'm getting tons of attack emails on Biden for this diplomatic, boycott.
Really?
Because he's not going far enough. He's weak. And I'm going, no, this is a pretty strong statement. Without punishing people whose lives have been competing in these games. I in no way think that we should boycott the games on any level.
Right.
Just my thought.
But, you know, we also tend to, you know, at the first blush of anger, we tend to sanction some country. You know, I guess we could sanction about 110 if we wanted to. And we do that. And then people call, well, you know, we've got to do this to China for the Olympics. And this is the right approach to do it. You know, it's doing something, but it's not doing something against the athletes who have, you know, trained hard and should go over and participate. So I think the president struck a balance.
Well, let's talk about Dr. Fauci. Evidently, Fauci's got a little back and forth with Ron Johnson, who's hopefully soon no longer going to be a senator from Wisconsin. What's going on there?
Well, Johnson's been after Fauci for quite a while. And so what Johnson is doing is he's referring back and he's trying to link during the AIDS epidemic some statements that Fauci had made. And Johnson is saying that, you know, he overhypes things. He overhyped the AIDS issue in a certain way, and now he's overhyping the COVID issue. And what he's referring to is a video that Fauci did where at the beginning, you know, onset with AIDS, they weren't sure of the contact point, you know, how you got it. Completely sure how it was going to be transmitted. So Fauci had made a statement, there's no question about it. I watched the tape, where he said that there could be close contact within households, and some of the kids might be able to, you know, have the acquired immune deficiency syndrome. So they're taking that in the initial, again, early stages of what they knew about AIDS, and they're using that to say that he overhyped the AIDS epidemic. Now, there were some scientists at the time and advocacy groups that didn't like his approach of trying to find a vaccine versus therapeutic treatment of AIDS. So that's where it boils down to. I think probably he's lucky that Johnson, in a sense, attacks him because, you know, Johnson's Johnson. All right.
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, the right's been attacking him a lot because he's kind of the lightning rod on this. I mean, this is the guy who we're going to for his expertise. And look, if there are outrageous statements like that, you know, I guess you could attack him for it. But I remember the whole grid era and then eventually the AIDS era where nobody knew anything. And you know, to be safe, you tried to protect people. And I tend to err on the side of caution myself anyway as well.
And I think with the COVID pandemic, what has happened is it's science, and science is not exactly exact. And so Fauci, if you look back at some of the statements that he's made, it was early on about the percentages of what has herd immunity, what would help us. And then he said, well, it's a little higher than that. So, you know, that was taken that he wasn't, quote, accurate. Well, he was accurate at the time because they thought 70 or 72% Rick was herd immunity. I think what they're really grasping for, though, is trying to find something where he is linked to supporting, you know, the Wuhan labs, which money was put into Wuhan labs, but it wasn't put in there to create a virus, you know, that. And that's not what did happen. I think it came from China, but I don't think, obviously, any money was used to, you know, create a virus.
Yeah, I mean, I come back to where I was, where I started from. I think that, you know, this was a place where that was at. They mishandled stuff. It ended up getting into those wet markets, and I think that's how it transmitted. I don't think that there was any malicious intent in this.
Right.
At least, at least I don't think there was.
It went through. I think it went through the wet markets, or some people think that it was accidentally taken through, you know, lab carcasses that were not killed and were maybe removed by somebody and sold. I mean, they don't know, but definitely I think the wet markets had it.
Yeah, and the thing is the conspiracies are always going to be out there.
Sure.
For me, now knowing, you know, getting the you know, that part of it is not as important to getting this under control right now. We'll have time down the road. But right now it's figuring out how do we protect ourselves?
Sure.
How do we save people?
And
how do we deal with this?
It's changed the workplace.
Yep.
It's changed, you know, every aspect of our society. And the president's goal is to get more people vaccinated. And that's the goal that anybody in the know has had. And that's still where the fight remains.
What do you think of Howard Stern's comments today?
What did he say?
We're a country of morons.
Oh, did he?
He said, send all the unvaccinated people to Mississippi.
Howard Stern's always been entertaining. In fact, one of the things that we found when Ellen Ratner was creating Talk Media News Service, we were looking at some research that showed that more of the dedicated listeners to Howard were people that hated him. So you got to give him credit.
Yeah. No, I mean, I love listening to Howard. You know,
right.
I liked him better when he was on terrestrial radio, where he couldn't say things which he knew he wanted to. Now it's not as entertaining as it was, but you know, there's something wrong with a society where the guy who was telling, you know, fart jokes is now making the most sense.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, where do you go from there?
I don't know.
Let's talk about 2020. Lot of vulnerable Democrats going to be in 2020. What are we thinking is going to happen?
Well, now this one is a potential trap for them if they're not smart about this. And the reason I mention this gives me flashbacks to, you know, I was elected in 1994, as you know. 1996, we ran and we were all being morphed into Newt Gingrich. And I can remember the battle that occurred, which is occurring now. Right now, vulnerable Democrats want less Trump talk. So they want colleagues in the Democrat National Committee, et cetera, to say less about Trump. You know, they want to keep it contained down. Congressman Susan Wild from Pennsylvania, a Democrat, had told Axios today that they're going to vote because they want to see people get stuff done, and people don't want to hear about Donald Trump. You know, she was mentioning that. And then a rep from Georgia said all politics is local. So there's this internal struggle where they're telling the DNC, watch what you do. Now, the DNC, Democrat National Committee, Rick, as you know, is going to raise money off of going against Donald Trump.
Correct.
Plus, if people sit there and don't, I mean, they shouldn't preoccupy every day with Donald Trump because there's an agenda here. Build Back America. Education, working rights, COVID, you know, all these things have to be pushed by the majority in Congress. But Trump's a factor and a part of it, and he's not going to sit there silent. So there's a little struggle. But it reminds me of the Gingrich days. And what we did, look, I had a district that was 16% Republican index, 16. And I was a Republican, and they were going after Newt Gingrich. We ran our own show. I didn't rely on the Republican National Committee to quit running ads, you know, nationally. We did our own show, got our supporters out, who were obviously a lot of Democrats in the 16% Republican index, and we won. Now, it was the one narrow race I had, but we won. So if they want to make all politics local, then localize it yourself. And that's where they raise money.
Yep.
And the big key is getting people out to vote for you.
Yeah, I think you need that. That getting things done locally to say, hey, look what we've done. But I also think the prospect of another term of Trump and you know, some of the craziness that we're seeing out of the Boberts and the Greens and the rest of them, that's got to be something you're going after.
Well, yeah, they have to. Again, you don't want to become obsessed with it, and that's where I think the speaker has to be very careful about, you know, taking people off of committees. And then the Republicans string that along for 3 or 4 weeks, you know, and then the Democrat majority kind of comes to a standstill on these things. So they have to be, there's a fine balance, I guess.
Yeah.
so they should do have to say something. They can't sit and not say anything.
Yeah, so should Boebert be tossed off of her committee?
Well, you know how I feel about this. I don't think she should. And the reason I don't is, well, let me go to the political reason first. If you're the Speaker of the House, don't do the Republicans a favor.
Yep.
Let them deal
yep.
with the people on the committee.
That's what I said right from the start.
Let them deal with it. Don't do them a favor. That's number one. Number two, for the institution of the House over the years, there was a lot of great people there, both sides of the aisle. And there were some people out there that, you know, I couldn't stand. I'm sure some of them couldn't stand me, don't get me wrong. But you don't just dismiss people unless, you know, they're threatening, you know, to kill somebody or something. So no matter how bad or stupid or terrible the things they say, I think you have to be careful about it. But the number one political point is let the other party deal with it, you know? Deal with the embarrassment. Deal with the problems.
I took a lot of heat when Marjorie Taylor Greene was being taken off her committees, and I said, it's a bad idea. I said, you should keep her on that committee, especially the education committee, because anytime you go, hey, we need more money for education, and you just point to her, go, Exhibit A, the dumbest person on the planet. Did you see the tweet she put out? There's 600,000 people who die from cancer every year. We don't shut anything down for cancer. What are you? What kind of a moron statement is that?
Well, and again, if she's on the committee and vocal, you know, there's going to be some arguments with her, but she's also going to continue to say things. The Republicans eventually will say, oh, wow, what do we do? So, again, don't do them a favor. And that's why I'm a little distressed with watching this boil down, you know, to who's being thrown off committee. And, of course, if the Republicans take control, then they'll turn around probably and throw people off committee.
Yep.
And then pretty soon maybe there'll be nobody on committees.
Maybe that's what the Republicans have always wanted, in my view. So you're just giving them what they want.
Right, exactly.
There you go. Last thing I wanted to real quick get your thoughts on this. The DOJ is suing Texas over their voting districts. Is this going to go anywhere?
Well, I mean, it could. At least they're doing it, you know, to enter into the fray where the Supreme Court's not going to enter into.
Yeah.
So they're going to sue them over the new redistricting maps. And I think it's probably a bold step for the Justice Department to do it. And their lawsuit's going to claim that the Republican-controlled state violated part of the Voting Rights Act.
Yeah, and who's
so if justice doesn't defend the Voting Rights Act, who is going to?
Exactly, exactly.
And I think it was great they stepped up for the first time in modern history with contempt cases. Those just sat and languished, you know, for 4 or 5 years. But getting involved in this one is a big deal. And then that way, it set maybe a precedent that, you know, legislatures will do what they want and they'll have redistricting plans, but it can't violate, you know, the Voting Rights Act.
What's left of it.
A big deal in this country.
I'm with you. Bob, I appreciate the time. Always great stuff.
Well, thank you, Rick.
Our good friend Bob Ney, one of my favorite people. Good stuff. The voting rights thing, this is a big deal. The fact that the DOJ is going to take this case and sue over what's gone on in Texas, the gerrymandering, I'm waiting for it to happen in other states, like Ohio, like Pennsylvania eventually. I don't think we should have caricature, you know, little bizarre cartoon districts. I do believe that they should be somewhat compact and contiguous, but not written in ways and drawn in ways that benefit the person sitting in the office. Voters should be choosing politicians, not politicians choosing voters. And if we do gerrymander, and I'm not 100% against the idea of gerrymandering, we should do it to have more equal districts so that we have competitive districts. Just my thought. I'd love to hear yours. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. You got any questions, comments, something on your mind? That's the way you get a hold of me. If you missed any of the program, thericksmithshow.com. That's where you go to get the podcast. The Rick Smith Show app on the smartphone. Take the program on the go, wherever you go. And as always, like I said, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Follow us on social media, @ricksmithshow. Twitter, Facebook, all of that. YouTube, share, like, all of it. Thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1897. London became the world's first city to license motorized taxicabs. More than a century later, cab service has seen many changes. Today's taxi drivers are an important sector of workers trying to win union recognition. The National Taxi Workers Alliance organized in 2014 in New York City. It is affiliated with the AFL-CIO. Traditionally, each taxicab driver in the U.S. has been classified as an independent contractor. This means that a taxi driver union could not appeal to the National Labor Relations Board for recognition of its right to represent workers. But this didn't stop the determined taxicab drivers. They organized their union anyway. Being a cab driver is extremely difficult. Workers are often on the streets for long hours a day, 6, sometimes 7 days a week. The U.S. Department of Labor labels taxi driving as one of the country's most dangerous professions. Taxi workers are forced to buy the fuel that they use and pay high lease rates for their vehicles. Most taxi workers also must lease medallions, which are the permits required for cabbies to pick up passengers. As independent contractors, the taxi workers are on their own to buy health insurance. Jamal Hussein, a National Taxi Worker Alliance member and taxi worker, said, "All the risk is ours. If gas prices rise, we earn less. If it's a slow day, we earn less. But the company gets its money no matter what." Taxi drivers now have to deal with the growth of ride-sharing services such as Uber. These ride-sharing services do not have to meet the same regulations and safety requirements as taxi drivers. Organizing drives have spread to other cities. In Chicago, AFSCME has helped to lead a series of cab driver actions. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.